This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
You're now listening to Boomsies with Dan O'Toole on the BetRivers Network.
Episode 81 of Boomsies, the Marion Hossa episode. 1,300 games played in the NHL, 525 goals, one of only 47 players to reach 500, three cups, and described by former teammates as the best guy ever. So he's okay in our books. Our guest today is a Canadian baseball legend. He lived my dream. 16 years in the big leagues, won 132 games, saved 87. So technically, he helped to win over 200 Major League Baseball games. Won a World Series in 2013. Inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame in 2019. We are proud to call him one of our own, Mr. Ryan Dempster. I wanted to add in a middle name, but nowhere on the internet can I find your middle name.
Oh, Squat. It's Scott. I can't believe you can't find it. It's whoever, I don't know if my parents didn't put it on somewhere, but yeah, Scott is my middle name.
Ryan Scott Dempster. Welcome to Boomsies.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
We're diving into your career. I hope that's okay, because I find it fascinating to talk to guys who lived a dream. And the question I've never asked anyone is, when you were growing up, was there a light bulb moment where you said, you know what, I'm pretty dang good at this?
Oh, wow. Well, yes and no. Like, I always just kind of believed I was going to be a baseball player. Like, my baby book, I think, pre-kindergarten, I'm 4 years old, what I want to be when I grow up, Major League Baseball player. I'm like seventh grade, and we had a career day where your parents, my dad was a fire chief at the time. He brought the fire truck and all that kind of stuff to school. And afterwards we went over what we wanted to be. And I remember Mr. John Loudon, who was our seventh grade teacher. He said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a professional baseball player. And he said, oh, that's so great, Ryan. What about like a firefighter too? Like your dad, that would be good, you know? Cause the reality was, coming from Gibson's BC, you weren't going to play professional sports. But then when I was probably 16, that's when it kind of like started to really like be like, oh, this is like going to be like a possible thing that could happen, you know, letters from colleges and scouts coming out to games. So then it was like, you know, I'm pitching at Ambleside Park in West Vancouver, and I got, you know, a bunch of scouts out there with radar guns and my Uncle Russ holding a hairdryer. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. And that's kind of probably the moment where I knew this was going to be a possibility.
So were you always a pitcher? Because back in the day, you would hear some guys drafted as an outfielder and then change. I like Dave Steeb was an outfielder. Then he got switched over to being a pitcher. You were always a pitcher.
Yeah, well, I was actually. I got discovered by the North Shore Twins head coach, Dave Empey, at the time, catching. I was catching, and I caught a lot growing up. I loved kind of just being the general behind the dish and watching the whole game. I played a little bit of third base in high school. But as I went into my junior year of high school, so 11th grade, my coach was like, hey, listen, do you know, this was pre-Shohei Ohtani, right? So two-way players weren't a thing. And my swing also was, you know, as it was when I played. So the chance of me being a hitter wasn't very good. And he was like, what do you want to do? Because we can work really hard at one of the two, but we're not going to be able to do both. And so I said, I'd like to pitch, and just kind of basically dedicated my time to that, my routine to that, my bullpen sessions, my work, my running, my lifting, my, you know, arm exercises was all geared towards being a pitcher. That being said, I did play a little bit of outfield and some, like I said, third base on days I wasn't pitching and stuff. But it was primarily pitching. And then my senior year, it was almost extensively pitching.
When you were in the big leagues, did you have any teammates or opposition players who were position players and you said, man, that guy's got a better arm than me, they should be a pitcher?
Yeah, quite a few. I mean, you know, I also had pitchers who I thought could have done what Shohei Ohtani's doing, like Carlos Zambrano. Like, Z could have done that. I always said if you gave Z, you know, 500 at-bats in the big leagues, I felt like he could have hit 30 home runs easily because he just mashed baseball. I would say probably most of those guys would be outfielders, like Mark Kotze, who I played with. You know, I mean, he was a heck of a big league baseball player for 14 seasons. And, you know, but he was a closer at Cal State Fullerton. And, you know, he had a rocket of an arm in right field. And I was like, hey, if we're looking for a left-handed reliever on the trade market, why don't we just use this guy? Because he can deal out there. And, you know, there was a few guys that kind of had that kind of that arm. Where like maybe they were struggling. I remember Willie Mopena, he had a cannon of a right arm and he could hit the ball in batting practice a country mile, but there was so much swing and miss in there. And I remember we were on the bench one day and somebody's like, you should just make Willie Mo a pitcher because he throws 100 from the outfield. So, but now we're seeing that, right? That's the evolution of the game. We're seeing that A, it's possible to manage both and that you can be successful at both. So I think Shohei's the new kind of leading the new wave, the once in a generational player, and now people are going to strive for that.
So, Shohei, do you believe, because he's in the debate now, is he possibly the greatest baseball player ever?
I think that, you know, I don't ever put that on people because people like to give people like things that happen like a year into their big leagues and they're like, this guy's going to win like 3 or 4 Cy Youngs, and then we never hear from him again. Or, you know, there's something that it takes to have longevity in this sport. I played with a ton of people who play for a cup of coffee, some people who play for, you know, a season or two and are successful and then fall off the face of the earth. Do I think that's going to happen to Shohei? No. But that being said, to be the greatest player of all time or one of the greatest players of all time, you have to have longevity. So if he doesn't get hurt, and he continues to go out there and play Major League Baseball for the next, let's just say 10 years, let's call it 8 years of highly productive years, then yeah, because there's nobody's done who's done what he's done. Like, you could say Babe Ruth, but that's, he's going to quickly surpass all those career marks as far as wins and all that kind of stuff. And then to do what he's doing and doing it in an era where there's so many other distractions off the field that can take you away from that and wants and needs and social media and all these things. I think what he's doing is we take it for granted because we just think, oh, it's pretty easy. And it's beyond hard to do one of the two, and to do both of them at an elite all-star level is a joke.
How are you as a hitter? I didn't look up your hitting stats.
All I say is I just wish I would have had one more hit because I love Wayne Gretzky and he's awesome and I'm glad I'm tied to him with my 0.99 career average. But I wasn't a strong hitter, Dan. It just was not my, but I could bunt like nobody else. I would have put myself up in one of those bunt tournaments that go on in Japan or Korea where they do that at the All-Star game because I could place a bunt, you know, pretty well. Led the league a couple times in sack bunts, but yeah, and contact. I could make contact. I looked at it this way: if I could make the starting pitcher throw or the pitcher throw 5 pitches in that bat to me, if I could foul off a few pitches and maybe come up with a hit, if I do that 3 times in a game, that's one less inning that he's throwing because it's about 15 pitches. That honestly was my goal. I took the Greg Maddux approach: get all my bunts down and try and hit the left field foul pole. Yeah.
What happened to pitchers getting hits and putting on the starter's jacket? Because up here in Canada, we didn't see a lot of National League baseball. So when the Jays played in the World Series, and classic Todd Stottlemyre gets a hit, he's wearing the starter's jacket. That's when he banged up his chin. When did that leave the game of baseball? Because I just always found it fascinating. Oh, he's putting on his jacket.
Yeah, and it was always, like you said, that like shiny kind of like
the shiny satin starter's jacket. Yep.
Yeah, it was so good. Yeah, I would say that probably left like in the beginning of the 2000s. Guys started doing stuff. I did it. You wrap your arm in a towel, and then you find out later on that physiologically it takes 4 hours for your body to shut down anyway. So you would have been just fine with no jacket, and it wouldn't really made a difference. But yeah, there was something to that, like, you know, like I laugh actually a little bit when we look back and we're like, time. And here comes the bat boy running out. And it was like a spectacle. It was almost like a wrestling, like you expect, like, you know, some sort of great intro music and put the jacket on rather than taking it off. And then And then what happens? We just stand there on first base. Nobody's stealing anything anyways. Nobody's going anywhere. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I miss those jackets. I wish we'd bring those back.
Oh, stellar. So as a pitcher, how many times would you go into the batting cage? Because I always would wonder, I'm like, well, why don't they just spend more time? You do spend a lot.
Yeah, a lot. We would. And like, let's be honest, man. Like, okay, so you take yourself back to those eras of pitchers hitting. And like, really when it became a thing, right? Like where pitchers really hit, like, you know, look at Fergie Jenkins. Look how many baseball games he won because he could hit. And not just because he drove in the winning run, but because he could hit, then he didn't get pinch hit for, and then he stayed in the game longer, and then he's able to go out there and pitch those games that are longer, right? So there was just this element, and you look at teams that took pride in that. The Atlanta Braves, I mean, I watched it firsthand across the field from the Marlins. We'd go to Atlanta, and they'd be taking batting practice early every day and raking, and yeah, we would, but it wasn't as serious, and therefore, those guys, you know, the bottom of the lineup, every out matters. And if you can make yourself a little bit tougher of an out, if you can handle the bat, if you can hit and run, like I said, if you get your bunts down. There was this crazy stat, and it was brought attention to me by a veteran pitcher when I was working early in the batting cage in 1999 in spring training, Alex Fernandez. And he said, listen, get your bunts down. He goes, you should be able to bunt 100 miles an hour and figure out how to bunt. And it starts in this cage. I want you here every morning. We're going to be here at 6 a.m. and we're going to work on bunting and hitting and bunting and bunting, and we're going to bunt a lot. And he goes, because at the time, right, that was prevalent. It was a part of the game, especially in the National League. And he goes, if you look at your sacrifice bunts and your win total at the end of the year, they're going to be pretty close. And I was like, really? And then I started to like, I went back and, you know, you look around the league and then even my own self, like I remember one year it was 15 sack bunts, 15 wins, you know, 16 sack bunts, 14 wins, 19 sack bunts, 17 wins, like 8 sack bunts, 9 wins. It's just, it was literally like a thing. And so, and why make yourself an easy out? Why not make it harder on the pitcher? I know what it's like to pitch with a runner on first, and it's sure not as much, you know, it's not as much fun when there's a runner on second, because now you have to worry about a base hit and a runner in scoring position, all this stuff. So, yeah, getting the bunt down, you know, at the time was something I really, really prided myself on. I knew I wasn't the best hitter, but there wasn't anybody as good at getting a sack bunt down as me, and I took a lot of pride in it.
You see about one bunt a month now in the majors. Do you see in Japan, as part of their all-star festivities, they have a bunting contest? I'm like, bring that crap to Major League Baseball, because that's entertaining.
Well, 100%. And like, I'll look at it this way, right? This is what I always say about the bunt. And I get the analytic side. I've learned to evolve and understand it. But understand this. First inning, a guy gets to second base, right? The problem is guys don't even know how to bunt. Like last night in the Cubs game, I was watching the Cubs game. They're playing the Reds. They're down by 2 runs in the 7th inning, and they got runners on first, second, none out. And Seiya Suzuki comes up. And Seiya Suzuki has no sack bunts in 2 years in the major leagues, and I think he had one in Japan. So automatically, you know, and Jim Deshaies and Boog were talking about it on the broadcast, was, yeah, we want to say bunt, right? Like, that's the play. Bunt them over, get a runner. But the reality is that you also have to have the tools to be able to do that. And if you don't have those skills, well, then good luck bunting the 95 coming from the pitcher, because you're not going to be able to do it, because it's never worked on. Because statistically, it says that if we go ahead and swing the bat 3 times, we got a better chance with OPS and driving in 2 runs than we do of bunting the guys over with strikeouts nowadays. Okay, I understand all that. But first inning, you bunt a guy over to second base. You are now leading the game 1-0 if you want to talk statistics, because what happens is it's the first inning, the infield all plays back. The pitcher in his mindset goes, I don't want the big inning, you know, I'm going to go ahead and like, if we give up a run right here, no big deal, a lot of game left. But what is it? 69, might even be 70% of the team that scores first wins. So there's stat number one, that how do we not just try our hardest to go ahead 1-0 through whatever means possible to go ahead 1-0? Because if you're going to play the data and the analytics, then the analytics would say that the team scores first wins most of the time. There would be a line outside of a casino door if that was a game that you walked in and it said 70% winning odds. Everybody would line up to play. Second of all, if you get the lead and now all of a sudden they want to go to the bullpen, who's coming in? Not your setup guys. You know, like the other team, if you're leading the game, they're going to bring in their B reliever, right? The guy who maybe not you don't bring in when you have a lead. Now you're facing lesser of a reliever. Like, there's so many different facets just by getting ahead, by getting the run in. And now when you do that and all of a sudden you're facing a little bit less of a reliever, now all of a sudden you're able to sit there and get a bit better pitch to hit or get a bit of favorable account because these guys don't get ahead. And now all of a sudden that's when you break the game wide open and everybody has a good time. I gave myself up in the first inning with the sack bunt. I'm rewarded. There's baseball gods. There's people upstairs that are taking care of the people who play the game the right way. So I understand that swing, 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 go for slug. Yeah, cool. But I also really love pitching with a lead. And now I'm the pitcher. Now I know as a home pitcher, this is at a home ballpark and it's 1-0 and I give up a solo home run, cool, it's still tied. But when it's a tie game, I'm a little bit more – there's just so many elements that come to having the lead that and the bottom line is we can't even do it anymore because it's never – practice. It's not get them in, get them over. And but in batting practice, it's not worked on. It's nothing. It's irrelevant. If a guy bunts, it's because a manager believes he can control the bat, so he gives him the bunt sign. It's never worked on, not in practice, not in the backfields, barely in the cage. It's an individualistic thing now if somebody wants to be good at bunting.
I don't know if you watched. Did you grow up watching the Jays?
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. Absolutely. So, at Simon Fraser University when Joe Carter hit that walk-off.
Tony Fernandez, he would bunt probably about 60 times a year. And then he'd do also the running bunt. Remember those?
Yeah.
No one does that now.
He would drag it, especially if he had a left-handed pitcher, you know, and like you could sit there and that guy's falling off, push the bunt towards second base. There's so many different elements, but I get it. We all love the sexiness of a home run. Even if you strike out 9 straight times, you know, like Joey Gallo, and then you go deep and you hit a $1.80 for 5 straight years, you just keep getting jobs. Nobody cares.
Yeah, well,
no offense to Joey
Davis.
Gallo. I'm not knocking him, but it's just the expectations aren't that high anymore.
Well, Chris Davis in Baltimore, he's still getting paid, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the nice part is he's just not striking out as much anymore.
So you grew up a Jays fan, so you know this guy over my shoulder, Garth Orge, greatest batting stance in the history of baseball. He came on this podcast and I asked him, I'm like, why did you have that stance? And he's like, things weren't going right. And I saw clips of a game because you couldn't watch tape or anything back in the day. So I'm like, I'm going to try that. And he tried it the next day without even going into a batting cage. And he just kept it the rest of his career.
Wait a second. Hold on a second. You mean Garth Orge, first of all, is standing behind you. That's amazing because he was one of my favorite players. And second of all, you're saying things weren't going right, so he made an adjustment like right away. He didn't do the same thing over and over hoping it would change? Man, God.
Like massive adjustment, a stance innovative. That makes no sense.
But that's what you did. What's the fear for guys that you – like I would always love that. Like I played with guys who like – you know, like, and I was a pitcher, I'd be like, hey, dude, you want to use my bat? And they're like, I feel good with mine. I'm like, you're one for your last 32. You know, like, how about turn it around and hold the barrel and hit with the handle? You know, like a pitcher, like, when I was going through struggles, it was like, I'm going to do something different. You know, like, maybe it was just like, maybe it was just even approach instead of just, now the process. I love the process. I'm all for the process. I believe in the process. But sometimes we just got to change things up just to say, screw it. Let's do something different. And like for him, I remember that batting stance and making that extreme change. And like, and then you find something that works for you. Like Mariano Rivera had four different cutter grips before he finally found that cutter grip. Like if you don't evolve in the game of baseball, it'll pass you by, man. It'll just keep going. You always got to adapt and evolve, at least if you want a career at it.
Where did the wide open batting stance go? The Mike Bordick, the Tony Batista stance where you're literally facing the pitcher. That stance is gone.
That's gone. Yeah, there's that doesn't happen anymore. There was a few guys who did that. I love the Tony Batista. It was just so great, you know. I mean, I remember Cal opened up like that at one point, you know, and there's just
Batista's swing looked effortless too. Like,
yeah,
it looked like he barely swung the bat.
That's how he generated his power. You know, he would fit nicely in today's game because he wouldn't have to worry about striking out. If he could strike out 200 times and hit 40 homers, you know, it'd be great. So, but yeah, like there was an evolution to it. And he tinkered with his even. And guys just, guys did that. Sometimes I think we get into a, you know, a robotical, this can be like this, just do this, because this computer image shows that if you do this, you know, then you're going to be successful. We got you in a pitch lab or in a hitting lab, and those things are super impressive tools, but there's a guy 60 feet, 6 inches away that you're competing against, and you just got to do what makes you feel comfortable, both as a hitter and as a pitcher. I can't speak, obviously, with that kind of batting average in my career as what it takes to be a hitter. But as a pitcher, you just got to do what makes you feel comfortable. Maybe you notice nowadays so many guys, the starting pitchers out of the stretch, they're all out of the set position. They don't even go out of the windup because they have troubles repeating their delivery. So they go simplify it. Good for them. That's an adjustment. What's comfortable for them. Some guys, they go up over their head like Max Scherzer and never have changed because that's what's comfortable for them. You got to find comfort first. And then your kind of results should follow after that. Nothing worse than feeling uncomfortable out on the mound or uncomfortable in the batter's box. You know, like I felt uncomfortable in the batter's box for about 500 ABs. Yeah.
Who is your favorite pitcher growing up? Please say Dave Steeb.
You said him, Dave Steeb, man, that slider. I mean, I was known for my nasty slider, and I watched so many Dave Steeb. I watched my heart get broken for him when he lost no hitter on a turf bounce over the top of, I believe it was, I want to say it might have been, who was playing second, Domiso Garcia, or maybe it was Manny. Lee. Somebody was at second. Or it might have been, but it might have been Roberto Alomar, the no-hitter that he lost, and it bounced up over his head, but it might have been Domiso. I just remember it in the off the turf, and he had no hitters, like with two outs in the ninth, what, two or three times, and he was nasty, man, and just like that mustache and the tight pants and like he's chewing tobacco, he's just spitting, and he just was just bulldog mentality. I honestly felt like I had a lot of that in me just because of watching him grow up. But all those guys in the Blue Jays, like that was my team, you know, and the setup guys, Dwayne Ward, Tom Hankey, and you had Jimmy Key, all that kind of stuff. I love me some Blue Jays.
Dave Steeb adjusted his cup more than any other big league player in the history of baseball.
I just thought it was because he had a big piece, you know. That's what I thought.
Get a bigger cup then. Hey, conservative estimate. How many pitches do you think you've thrown in your life? Can you ballpark it?
Can I ballpark it?
Talking spring training. I'm talking like warming up, everything.
Well, go 3,000 for, let's just call 3,000 for a season as far as 30 starts at 100 pitches a start on a ballpark. It's 3,000 times that by, you know, roughly 20 years because you count minor leagues too, right? So you're looking at 60,000 right there, and then you can what, triple that? I'm going to go a quarter of a million, 250, maybe more, 400,000 actually. When you start to take high school and minor leagues and bullpen sessions and spring training, I'd say close to 400,000 pitches.
Okay, so how is your arm now?
Awesome. I could throw all day. I actually did that. So every year, Randy Hundley would throw this fantasy camp. Down in Arizona for Cubs fantasy camp. So all these people would pay money to come camp with, you know, guys like Fergie and Lee Smith and Bobby Dernier and Rick Sutcliffe. And you get all these players that come down and have a great time. And it was going to be the last year. It was actually January of 2020, pre-pandemic, and it was still going to be the last year. And Eddie Vedder is a good friend, and he called me and said, hey, this is going to be the last year of Randy Hundley's fantasy camp. Can you come down? And I had a bunch of things going, and it was extremely hard to make time to get down there. And I was like, I'll come in for a day. I'll do a full day of camp. I'll fly down. And so on the flight down, I was like, man, I'm only coming for a day. I should do something special, you know, like just pop in and out. I don't want to just not do anything. So I said, I'll throw batting practice to every camper, you know, like, so I get to the morning meeting and I was just stood up. I said, listen, I'm going to be on field four. I'm going to throw batting practice all day long. Every camper comes and we'll have fun. Right. Then I realized there's 125 campers and I would say on the low end, every camper got at least 5 pitches. And I would say the high end would have been like 15. Like if I felt like I was a little all over the place and nobody was getting swings. So I would say on average threw eight pitches. So that day I threw about 1,200 pitches. And I thought I was going to get up the next day and not be able to wipe my rear end. And I was actually pretty all right. I was like, oh, okay, I can move. So yeah, it's It's been great. I'm not going to lie. I was a little nervous after I got done playing, but it's been unbelievable how good it feels.
That's amazing. I love hearing that. I hate hearing about lingering injuries. Was there almost a time where you thought you would become a Blue Jay, or is there a regret that you never got to play for the Jays?
Regret, no, but a hope at some point. When I was a free agent in after 08, I was a little bit, maybe was hoping there was a little bit more interest from their side, just being a Canadian who was pitching really well, was coming off an all-star season. But there wasn't any interest at all. I can't even remember, to be honest with you, where they were at in 08.
It was it would have been the bad Jays uniform years. So you probably, it's a good thing because
yeah,
poor Roy Halladay, any clips you see of Roy Halladay, he had to wear the worst Jays jerseys of all time. The hats, everything.
Yep. Yeah, no, those were not their best years. They're coming back. I love the powder blues are amazing. The white with the the stencil type print on it is great. I love pitching in Canada. Like, I love pitching in Toronto. I love pitching in Montreal. When the Expos were there, I was undefeated at the Stade. It was it was great because there's very few Canadians in Major League Baseball, and especially at the time. And then to come back to your home country and have a good game, you could go wash it down with a nice cold Molson or Kokanee and some ketchup chips. It was pretty special.
Americans, I don't know what your take is, but so I worked at Fox for 4 years, and I'd bring down ketchup chips, and there is no middle ground. The crew would either love them or hate them, and a lot of them consider them really spicy. What is your American take on ketchup chips that you've experienced?
I don't like the way that, first of all, that they've evolved. I think they've devolved ketchup chips. They used to be a little bit bigger with a little bit more crunch and a little bit more ketchup flavor. I feel like they've become whatever the powder they put on them now is a little bit. It is a little bit spicier than it used to be, and it was just Old Dutch, right? And then everybody else started making them. I remember Old Dutch was just like the first one, and they were just so good. Living down here, when I tell guys like ketchup chips, they're like, what? What is that?
Which is bizarre because ketchup is so American.
Yeah, but it's funny though, not put on a lot of things. Like, growing up in Canada, ketchup on scrambled eggs, ketchup on mac and cheese. Ketchup on a lot of things, and we'll be in the food room, and I'm throwing ketchup, and people are looking at me like, "What are you doing?" That's just, it is an American thing. Obviously, Heinz, started down in, was that Pittsburgh or whatever, but it is an American condiment. But we grabbed a hold of something special and just ran with it up north of the border.
Before I dive into how well you know your career, Harry Carey, did you ever meet him when he was alive?
No, I never had a chance. He died in February of 1998, and I came up to the big leagues in 1998, and made my first start at Wrigley. So, it would have been really special to have that opportunity. But feel like I know him pretty well now.
And did Will Ferrell and you ever do your Harry Careys? Because I saw a clip of you guys. You were eating pizza on the field together, and I didn't really understand what was happening there.
Yeah, that was a first pitch that Will and Zach Galifianakis, Zach, they were in town promoting the movie The Campaign, and I always, every time Will would come through, I've got a little bit of a friendship relationship with him, and I always catch the first pitch, and I'd caught other ones in the past, and then and he said, "Hey, listen, something's gonna happen, so just be ready." And sure enough, he had a pizza delivered, right before the first pitch. A pizza delivery guy came out to the mound, he called me out, and we shared a slice of pizza. Which was really fun. And then he stole my glove and he took that, away with him, which he later told me he gave to a guy that was asking for spare change out in front of a Dick's Sporting Goods. I don't know if that's a true story or not, but, I thought it was, pretty on point with something Will would say, but, it was a lot. We did actually have a little bit of fun with some Harry Carey the first time he came through, the locker room, kind of going back and forth, and, yeah, he's quite the character. Mine's Will Ferrell-esque with a little bit more hairy and a little bit more. I don't search for the unrealistic things that Harry might say. I actually try to go down the path of what he actually might say.
Starter and a closer, you were both. As a closer, I can't imagine a more stressful situation. Does it feel like that when you're actually in it?
No, it's a great adrenaline rush. It's a lot of fun. I mean, stress or, you know, nervousness, I think, is just a lack of preparation. So, you know, I always felt prepared to go out there and get the job done. It is a pretty big adrenaline rush. Maybe a little bit more nerves on the road because you're dealing with another team's home ballpark. But also, you know, a pretty special feeling when you're in St. Louis and you got a chance to close the ball game out and Albert Pujols is up and you can get them out and quiet that whole crowd real quick. You can feel like a conductor, right? Like you just sit on the mound and just do this and get everybody hyped up and then throw one good slider and then just be like, boom, you know? So it is a thankless job, you know, in a way. Like I admire guys like Mariano and Hoffy and, you know, guys like Rod Beck, rest his soul, you know, and even going back, Lee Smith, you know, Goose Gossage, these guys, because it is a thankless. You save 30 in a row and nobody says boo. They don't even come to your locker to say, hey, how'd the save go? Like, you're just expected to, no matter what the situation, no matter what's going on. I remember I'd saved like 23 or 26 in a row, and then I gave up a 3-run homer to Andre Ethier at Wrigley Field that landed in the basket on windblown home run with two out, like fly ball to left, not even close. And it lands in the basket, just keeps blowing and blowing. And I go out to the parking lot after the game and I just hear a Cubs fan go, move back to Canada, Dempster, you loser. And I'm like, oh, this is what it feels like to be a kicker for the Dallas Cowboys. Okay, cool. Yeah. Right on. I get it. You know?
Yeah. Oh man.
Like it's kind of funny.
And those people
like,
now exist online.
Yeah, and if you think about it, it's hilarious. Like, you could be winning 10-0, right? And give up 10 runs and then score one run in the top of the inning. And then in the bottom of the inning, the closer comes in and gives up a run. And after the game, or two runs to lose the game, after the game, nobody talks to anybody who gave up the 10 runs. Let's talk to the closer because he blew the game. They had a chance to win it, and he blew the save, you know? And it's like...
Well, it's the same as a goalie in hockey. They had to get through five players to get to him, so...
Yeah.
To everyone else.
Right? They just go, what happened on there? And then you can't throw your teammate under the bus ever, you know? And don't get me wrong, 90% of the saves I blew were my fault.
Did you have an entrance song as a closer?
For a little bit, I had TNT by AC/DC. That was a good intro song.
Okay, here we go. We're going to see how well Ryan Scott Dempster knows his career. The hitter you struck out the most.
Whoa, hitter I struck out the most.
18 times.
18 times. I'm going to say Ricky Weeks.
Lance Berkman.
Oh, yeah. God, man, he sucked. Not a good hitter.
The player that hit the most home runs off you with 8.
Albert Pujols.
You got it. What hitter did you own? 18 at bats, 0 hits.
18 at bats, 0 hits. Can you give me a team?
I'm pretty sure it was he. Yeah, he was Milwaukee.
Corey Hart.
Niger Morgan.
Niger Morgan. I wait. As I said it, I knew it. Yeah.
Interesting stat. Interesting fact about Niger Morgan. Played in the WHL for the Regina Pats at one point.
Yeah. Remember when he fought Chris Volstad? Chris Volstad hit him, and Chris Volstad's 6'9", and Niger Morgan's 5'10", and Niger landed the one and only good punch of the fight.
Yeah. I don't remember that. Yeah. Is it on YouTube?
It's on YouTube. Yeah. Volstad down in Florida. It was pretty good.
And this is the craziest one. Actually, I couldn't find... How did Barry Bonds do against you?
6-for-10 with a triple, 5 singles, and 5 walks, I believe. And the triple. Here's a great story about the triple. So this is really great. So Barry's in the midst of everything. He's hitting home runs all over the place. And I'm getting ready to take the bottom of the first inning at AT&T Park at the time. I, I think it's Oracle Park now or whatever. But and I'm walking up the stairs in the dugout, and I feel this jersey pull on me, like back by my belt loop to just back in the dugout. And I turn around, and there's Kevin Millar, my teammate, and he goes, "Hey, listen, everybody's scared of Barry. You go out there and find out what you got against Barry Bonds. Don't mess around right after him, four-seam fastballs, challenge him." So I'm like, okay, let me see how the first goes. Like, so I get the first two guys out. Here comes Barry, you know, Dr. Dre's blaring through the loudspeakers. The crowd's going nuts. And Barry gets in the box, and I throw a first pitch fastball right down the middle. And Barry just goes, "Oh, okay." Like, he starts tightening up his elbow guard, like, "We're going to play. You want to do this. All right, let's go." And so then I throw another four-seam fastball. He fouls it straight back. I'm 0-2. I throw a fastball away, and he cranks it off the right center wall, that high wall in right center field there. Caroms around towards center for a triple. And I come back in the dugout, and Millar goes, "Well, he just found out he's a lot better than you, so don't do that again." You know?
I love that. So 6-for-10, Barry Bonds. How do you know what Sammy Sosa hit against you?
My guess would be in the 270, 260 range. He had two homers, I believe it was, two home runs.
What I found was 9 at-bats, no hits.
No, that's wrong.
That's an incorrect stat?
That's an incorrect stat because that might be a different Sosa. Maybe like, you know, Jorge Sosa or Edmund Sosa.
No, it was Sammy.
Because he hit a home run my very first start. I went strikeout on 3 pitches to Brant Brown in the bottom of the first inning. Thought, man, I guess the big leagues aren't that hard. And then I walked Mickey Morandini, and Sammy took me deep. And then I walked Mark Grace, and Henry Rodriguez took me deep. So, and then I gave up a home run to Sammy down in Florida another time. I think he was like 247, well, I want to say.
See, I thought you just owned Sammy Sosa going 0-for-9, so I'm getting my stats from the wrong place.
It is weird how you own certain guys and other guys. Like, I couldn't get Fred McGriff out, you know, the newly inducted Hall of Famer, to save my life. Like, it was crazy. It was just a lot of offense of him, Luis Gonzalez. But, like, Joe Mauer, I just crushed Joe. At one point, Joe Mauer was 0-for-7 with 6 strikeouts. Like, the guy never struck out, and I punched him out 3 times a game. Like, it was just nuts just to be able to, like, try and wrap your head around why certain guys get hits and why certain guys don't. You know, like you mentioned Berkman striking him out 18 times, yet he was one of the toughest ABs I ever had. You know, it was like always tough to face him.
Who had the hardest hit ball against you?
No doubt, not even a question. Vladimir Guerrero Sr. at Pro Player Stadium. I hung a slider and he hit it into the upper deck. And normally when people hit home runs and then they land and then they roll back down that tarped area that was covered in the upper deck, he hit the tarp and the ball rolled up about 8 rows. Like, the stadium got in the way. And they're like, "That's an estimated 442 feet. I'm like, there was 442 feet left on that ball if that upper deck didn't get in the way. Like, that ball, like, that FAA was going to call the Marlins and be like, "Listen, we can't have this going on if that upper deck didn't get in the way."
You couldn't get two more polar opposite swings of players you just mentioned. Fred McGriff, effortless, while Vladdy Guerrero Sr., he came out of his boots on every swing.
Yeah, and you know what I loved about that Vladdy Guerrero? This is why I love, I competed against him forever. My, you know, he was, you know, same division, Montreal, everything, all these games we had against each other. But I like to think I played the game the right way. You know, I always tried to, like, you know, have respect for guys across the field, you know, respect for umpires, even though, like, I didn't always agree with them. And Vladdy hit that ball, and I turned around thinking he's still standing in the batter's box. And he was almost rounding first base. And this ball, I'm not kidding when I say it's 500 feet. That ball was hit 500 feet, no doubt. And he didn't style for a second. And I always remembered it because I was like, man, you know, It was like a moment where, like, you got respect from across the field, from the other guys on the field. And, like, that's ultimately what you want. Like, you know, yeah, the money's great. You can come and go with money. The game keeps – the day you retire, the game's over with, you know. But when you got respect to those guys from across the field and the guys in your own team, like, those are friendships for a lifetime. Those are guys you run into at the All-Star game, you know, 20 years down the road and you see them at an event and they're like, what's up? You know, cause they respected you. And to me, that was a moment where I was like, oh man, I got respect to that guy and I respect him. So it was pretty, pretty cool.
It's funny you mentioned that, that ball hit 500 feet and I saw someone looking at distances of home runs. Now they're like, okay, that ball, it went more than 480 feet. Yet we're still supposed to believe in 1918, Tommy Two Toes hit a ball 601 feet and they had no tape measures. And they just were like guessing, but we're still going with that stat. And I'm like,
thank you.
Yeah. I never really thought about those measurements. We're still going with from the 1900s.
Well, and we'll go back, right? Like we're going to go back with all the other analytics. We're going to go back and figure out what Ty Cobb's war was, because that was a stat back then, you know. We're going to figure out what you know, average exit velocity Babe Ruth had. We're going to go all that, but we're just going to go ahead and leave Ted Williams's red seat alone. Like, I crisped. Listen, I'm not the greatest Boston Red Sox ever, and I played with Big Poppy, is Ted Williams. I mean, this guy, legendary, right? Like, unbelievable, one of the greatest hitters we've ever seen. And I understand that he hit that red seat at Fenway. I get it. But you can't keep moving it back two rows every year and be like, that's the red seat he hit. Pretty soon that's going to be over on, like, parked somewhere behind the center field wall and be like, yeah, Ted Williams hit this red seat. Like, yeah, we get it. It used to also be just behind the bullpen. Like, I hit a 5-iron from the third base coach's box, and I'm a good golfer, and I crisp a 5-iron. Like, if I nutted, it's about 210. You know, back then, I got better clubs now. I went and got fitted, so I hit it a little farther. But, like, and I didn't even come close. 210 yards. That's 600-something feet, 650 feet, you know, or 630 feet.
And you never came close to the seat.
Not even close. So don't give me that crap. Either that or start saying that all the technology and these guys are bigger, faster, stronger. The guys are throwing harder and the bats are harder, yet the balls are going shorter. Poo-poo-y, change it, fix it, or start saying that the ones nowadays are going farther. One of the two.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. Ryan Dempster, we can't thank you enough for coming on here. You are a Canadian legend, and you have your rightful spot in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. So,
Dan, awesome. Thank you, man. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Always love talking the game and love talking it with my homies north of the border. It's great.
And how I close every episode, I say, hey, hug someone. You never know who needs it. And just be nice. It doesn't cost you anything.
You got that right.
Welcome to Boomsies with Dan O'Toole. Live from Orno in the heart of Ontario. Oh, baby, Boomsies.
Thanks for listening to Boomsies.